This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I just read a terrific book about the history of the Ku Klux Klan called The Second Coming of the KKK, and the author, Linda Gordon, shows how the Klan, which was originally focused on violently suppressing blacks in the South, was reborn in the 1920s as a nationwide movement. And in this second iteration, the Klan targeted not only African Americans, but Jews, Catholics, Muslims, Mexican Americans, and Asian immigrants. Discrimination was the new patriotism. Linda Gordon writes how millions of people joined the Klan in the 1920s in the span of just a few years, and among them were mayors, congressmen, senators, and governors. It's a period with very sobering lessons for our current moment.
One of the things your book makes so startlingly clear is that the Klan was not something that was to the side of American political life. How can you illustrate how deeply the Klan penetrated into political office and political life? How high did it rise? Didn't go to the presidency of the United States.
Well, almost, because several presidents were, in fact, members, such as Harry Truman. But most of them, I think there were three presidents who were probably members.
Harry Truman was a member of the Klan.
Yes, he was. But as soon as he decided to move into the national political arena, he resigned.
How is that not disqualifying to his entire political career?
There's no reason at all why it should have disqualified him. This was an entirely reputable, supposedly legitimate organization. It was not the least bit secret. They advertised in newspapers. They identified themselves when they ran for office as Klansmen. But lacking polls, we can also point to the legislative and electoral achievements of the Klan. The Northern 1920s Klan elected 11 governors, 45 congressmen, and I'm not counting what were almost certainly hundreds of state, local, municipal officials.
What were their big issues? What was the legislation that Klan pushed for in the 20s?
One piece of Klan legislation had already passed, and in many ways it was the Klan's biggest victory, and that was the 1924 immigration law, the first time the federal government restricted immigration. And that law installed into our immigration policy the exact hierarchy that the Klan had of who were superior and desirable and who were inferior and undesirable, and set quotas accordingly. So there were very large quotas for the so-called Nordics, very small quotas for groups that were not white Protestants in their view. I also think it's extremely important to remember the consequences of that act. That act remained the law of the land until 1965. It was certainly, for example, a factor that contributed to the failure of the United States to take in Jewish refugees from Nazism, because to do so, they had to work around these quotas. But beyond that, one of the Klan's main, after the march, one of the Klan's main struggles at the state level was to ban Catholic schools. They had both positive and negative arguments. The negative arguments are part of the Klan's masterful use of completely outrageously fake news. It's that the Pope set the curriculum and was trying to undermine Americans, that these young people in Catholic schools were being trained to serve as what we might call moles, to be underground. And literally, the Klan claimed that the Pope was preparing a coup to take over the government of the United States.
These are prejudices that persisted right up until the presidential run of John F. Kennedy in 1960.
Absolutely. The notion
Popism.
That if you were a Catholic and therefore honored the Pope, you could not be a loyal American.
You know, one of the things that makes your book so riveting, and it really is how absurd and self-important the Klan rituals and their terms were. You assemble a glossary of Klan titles, you know, the various officers in the Klan at the end of the book, and it includes terms like King Kleagle, and I'm going to get the pronunciation wrong, Clarago and Clavern and Klektokin and Klonklave and, you know, everything but Covefe. And what's with these terms? I mean, you look at these guys and they're absurd hats, and you think they're laughable, and they're anything but laughable.
Well, first of all, let me say that when I wrote this book, I realized right away I didn't want to waste my time just telling people how horrible the Klan was and condemning it. I wanted people to understand it.
And you don't describe them just doing horrible things. They're at picnics and barbecues and kind of family-friendly social events and so on. There's a certain kind of Sunday in the backyard quality to some of this absurd activity.
Yes, I wanted people to understand what could be attractive about the Klan. But as to these arcane names and rituals, yeah, I think that many people, at first anyway, enjoyed being a part of the Klan because it was like being a part of a theatrical group. You were enacting certain kind of rituals. And I might point out, many fraternal orders at the time, the Elks, the Masons, the Knights of Columbus, all had their rituals. So they were not that far out of the mainstream. But I do think, you know, when the Klan declined, it declined largely from internal causes. And one of them was, I think, that members of the Klan got a little bored with this.
But more chilling, you say that the Klan declined precisely because it had succeeded. It had triumphed in some ways. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think about the Immigration Act, the eugenics, the anti-miscegenation laws, the laws passed in all the states that forbade what was then called intermarriage. But I also think that its biggest achievement is the hardest to measure, and that is their tremendous impact for a long time on public opinion. And that is that they were legitimating a discourse that was not only racially bigoted but also religiously bigoted. And that was very, very damaging. I'm not saying that those prejudices weren't there previously, but I think it makes a big change when they come out in the open, when they are stated broadly, and when they are associated with patriotic Americanism.
Now, I don't think I'm imagining this, but as I read your book almost from the very start, almost from the very first pages, the book is imbued with a sense of we've been here before and a kind of foreboding about the present and the near future. When you think about your research on the Klan and you think about the present moment and in the era of Trump, how do you relate them?
I see a number of important themes here. One of the most important is fear. I think that that kind of anger and bigotry is best revved up by making people afraid. You find the Klan, for example, claiming that these immigrants were stealing the jobs that belonged to true Americans. But what's interesting about that is that that claim took on great strength in states where there hardly were any Catholics or Jews. For example, Oregon, which happens to be my home state. So this notion of fear and these allegations of just outrageous notions. I mean, just one example, the Pope had already landed in disguise in Washington, D.C., and was building a palace of gold, which was going to be the future capital of the United States. So fear is extremely important. Another aspect of that that does concern me a lot is gullibility. Why do people believe such outrageous things? I'm not an expert at this. I'm no psychologist. But I suspect that a lot of what you believe derives from who tells it to you, where you hear it from. We know that thousands of ministers were lauding the Klan in their sermons, and some of them were reproducing these outrageous claims. You know, another aspect of the Klan that is of this Klan that is often forgotten, and one that is extremely relevant today, is that while Many people have labeled it a populist movement, and that label has become very popular today. Being a historian, I think that's very misleading, because the Klan not only had zero proposals or policies that would have helped what we might call the 99%, the sort of ordinary working class, lower middle class people who joined the Klan, but it actually lauded and honored the very, very rich.
How so?
You find statements like in some of the directions to local groups that be sure that you elect a, quote, big man to be the head of your local chapter, by which they clearly meant a man of economic and social success.
When you think right now about the base, the so-called base of Trump support, how much of that in your mind is related to anything that can be tied to what we're describing in the 20s? Or is it completely other? Is it completely divorced from that?
It's certainly not completely other. And I do have to point out that we don't have perfect knowledge about who joined, but we do have some good estimates. One of the things I'd like to point out as a way of getting into that is that the opponents of the Klan like to label them just a bunch of uneducated hicks, clodhoppers, people who are just dumb. And unfortunately, I see that repeated today in the way some people talk about Trump supporters. There are two things wrong with it. One is it's not true. The Klan had many educated people, people of standing in their communities, teachers, lawyers, engineers.
And presumably people who did not think of themselves as haters or hateful.
Exactly. Exactly. But the other thing wrong with that kind of thing is that it backfires.
Politically.
These disdainful put-downs of the Klan just made the Klan it made the Klan literally grow and build its resentment against these, quote, liberal, cosmopolitan, urban elites.
In a terrific review of your book in the New York Times, Clay Risen writes the following. There are two ways to think about this, meeting the Klan in the 20s. One could say, great, we've met the enemy before and defeated him. We'll do it again. Or we could realize that we've met the enemy and he is us, that the plague of xenophobia, racism, and nationalism is always present. Is this a snake? Is this an enemy, as Clay Risen puts it, that can never entirely be stomped out of American life?
It's probably true that it can never be entirely stomped out, although I would like to point out that it is not by any means exclusively American. In Europe, we see the rise of tremendously xenophobic people. In the Muslim world, this kind of religious intolerance of any deviation. So one might be inclined to say, well, it's never likely to be possible to simply get rid of bigotry. But on the other hand, I do believe that it can be resisted and controlled and that it can be contained. And one of the things we see both is, you know, the rise of not only Trump, but Trumpism, but also the rise of a resistance to that. And we see in the United States today, many, many thousands of people who have never been politically active, who have never gone to a demonstration, who now feel, all right, I have to step up. I have to say something about this. So I am somewhat hopeful, but it's not going to be easy.
Linda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Linda Gordon is the author of The Second Coming of the KKK and other books. She's a professor of humanities at New York University.